and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, Steve Barnes, wrongfully imprisoned for murder and rape for 20 years, tells his story. Hosted by the Alaska Innocence Project and the University of Alaska Anchorage Justice Center, Steve was recorded speaking at UAA's Rasmussen Hall on November 2nd.
I'm Bill Oberle. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Innocence Project. And for those of you who don't know what we are, we're a nonprofit group who works to identify and exonerate wrongfully convicted people and to change laws so that wrongful convictions won't happen in the future. We also rely solely on donations from the public for our work, so if Steve inspires you, don't hold back. Before I introduce Steve, I want to say two things for you to keep in mind when you're listening to Steve. One, for those of you who are 19, think about how you are now. That's when Steve's nightmare began. And for those of you who are 43 and older, that's when it ended. So think how you would react if you'd lost all those years. And one other thing I want you to think about is late last week, I heard a representative of the district attorney's office say there are no wrongfully convicted people in Alaska. So you know the work we have to do here. But without further ado, I have the honor of introducing someone who is my hero, someone who has the strength mentally and emotionally to withstand 20 years of wrongful conviction. Is a true hero in my book. So without further ado, I will introduce you to Steve Barnes.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here. As you know, my name's Steve Barnes. I'm from New York State, upstate New York. Not New York City. I'm from a small town in near Utica, New York. Quite a ways from here. Back in 1985, September 19th, 18th was, in the small town of Marcy where I grew up, not far from where I grew up, a 16-year-old girl was murdered and raped. On the morning of September 18th, I came down my street and there was a roadblock at the corner. They showed me a picture of this girl and asked me if I've seen her. I said, no, I haven't. And I went about my business that day. I went to a friend's house the rest of the day, and I came home later afternoon, 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I was going down the same road where they had the roadblock at the corner, and I wanted to get a six-pack at a convenient or a Marcy Discount Beverage Center, and I went by it, so I turned around the convenience center right next to where I had the roadblock, and there was an unmarked cop car on a payphone. I just made a U-turn, went in the Marcy Discount Beverage, it was called, and he followed right behind me. The sheriff department guy got out and asked me why my truck was muddy, asked me for my license registration, and I told him I went through the roadblock earlier that day, and I didn't know anything about what happened. I have not seen this girl. Ever since that day on, that was my beginning of my nightmare. 2 days after they pulled me over, it was on a Saturday, they called me up to the sheriff's department. They wanted me to answer some questions about this. I said, sure, I had nothing to hide. I was 19 years old, and I went up there, no problem. For the first 2 hours, the cops were nice. They started asking me questions where I was. I told them what I did from when I got up that morning until I went to bed. After a couple hours, they made me take my shirt off. They were looking for scratches. They took pictures of me. They fingerprinted me. They continued to drill me. They did tag team investigation they did to me. One officer walked in the room, looked me in the eye, slammed his hand on a desk and said, I did this, tell him how I did it. The other officer would leave, the other one would come in. They kept doing this, they kept drilling me. I kept telling them my story. I was telling the truth. They kept calling me a liar. This went on for hours. I've asked for a phone call. I asked to call my attorneys, a lawyer. I asked to call my mother, anybody in my family. They even denied me a glass of water. After about 10 hours of interrogation, I was a nervous wreck because they're accusing me of this. They asked me to take a polygraph test. So I said, sure, no problem. I went and got in this cop car and they took me to a trooper's barracks. They threw me in a room with a book that says, read that, and it tells you how a polygraph works. They put all these wires up to me and gave me a polygraph test, asked me a bunch of questions, and they said it came back inconclusive. I was a nervous wreck. I was being interrogated for over 10 hours. I was, you know, feared for my life. They were accusing me of killing somebody. I didn't even know what was going on. I didn't, you know, the cops drilled me. After that, about 6 months after that, they called my mother's house and asked me to come up to the local hospital to give up blood and hair. Again, I cooperated, no problem. For the next 2 years, them two invests followed me. I worked construction. They followed me to work. They hauled my girlfriend in at the time, drilled her, made her ask her all these questions about me. She came back. She came up to my house after the interrogation. She was a nervous wreck. For about 3 years, they made my life living hell. It was from 1985 to 1988. It was on March 25th, 1988, a little over 3 years after the murder happened. They came to my mother's house again, knocked on the front door and said, hi, Mr. Barnes, do you know who we are? You remember us? And I said, yeah, how could I ever forget your people's face? You made my life miserable for the last 3.5 years. They said, a couple people come forward and pointed the finger at me, and I was under arrest. I couldn't believe it. I was getting arrested for something I didn't do. My little brother was flipping out. My girlfriend was crying. I was screaming at the cops, calling them a few four-letter words. My brother was screaming at them. They put me in the cop car, and they took me back to the sheriff's law enforcement building. They called the local media. They walked me across the parking lot to the county jail. They cuffed me, stuffed me, they booked me. I was charged with second degree murder, rape. I was in the county jail approximately 60, 70 days. They finally let me get bail. My mother put up her house. I was out on bail approximately a year, 13 months, maybe 14 months, give or take a few weeks. After my trial started, after about a year, I was out on bail. It started in May of 1989. My trial lasted for about 14 days. It was 14 days of lying, maybes, perhaps, could have been, similarities. In my trial, I had an off-duty policeman. He was driving down the road where her body was found. And back in 1985, he said he didn't know who he saw or what vehicle he saw on Mohawk Street. He said after 3.5 years, his mind got better and he picked me and my truck out of a lineup. What the cops did is they made a photo array of me, of all these mug shots, all different types, and my picture was the only one with blonde hair. They asked the guy, what blonde hair guy did you see on Mohawk Street? I was the only one in the pictures with blonde hair. Then they had pictures of pickup trucks. Mine was two-tone red and silver. All the rest of them had no red, no maroon in them. They asked this witness, what maroon truck did you see on Mohawk Street? He pointed to mine because it was the only red one in the picture. When I was in the county jail for the 60, 70 days, the cops went down the gallery after I made bail and interviewed all the inmates on the gallery. There was about 19 of them with me, it would have been 20. They said, Mr. Barnes, any of you want to say anything about Mr. Barnes? So I had this guy, he took the stand, he was a jailhouse rat. He was facing 3 to 6. He had a long criminal background. He ended up doing 6 months in the county jail for testifying against me. He also testified in another murder trial that same year. When they searched my truck, in 85. They said they found, they had a criminologist lady say they had found a similar hair. They said there was a similar dirt under my wheel wells in my truck from the crime scene, and they took dirt 2.5 years after the crime scene. They said there was a similar gene imprint on the side of my truck, and they had a guy take the stand and said that they sold 3,000 pairs of jeans in my county that year of that pattern type of gene. I had other people that I thought were my friends. Well, the only friends I had when I got arrested were my mother, my brother, my sister. None of my homeboys stuck by me, not really. None of my so-called little friends that I grew up with, my buddies that I hung out with, the guys that I drank beer with. Some of them testified. I was going to another guy in my trial. I was stopped to get gas where I was heading that evening, and he testified that I went down the street where the crime had happened, where her body was found. Later on in the trial, he was cross-examined and admitted that he lied, and I did go down where I was supposed to, where I told him I was heading. It was to a local bowling alley. This went on for, like I said, my trial was for 14 days. It was hearsay similarities. After the 14th day, it was exactly 13 days, they gave it to the jury. The jury was out a little over a day. Every day my jury used to look at me and my lawyer when we were coming in and out of court. And the day they came back with the verdict, I was sitting home, I was out in bail, and they called me and said the verdict's in. I went back to the courtroom. Me and my lawyer were sitting there at the table, and the jury walked in and they looked at the ground. They didn't even look at us. And I remember telling my lawyer, I said, this doesn't look too good. I rose, and they gave the verdict to the judge, and they read the verdict. They found me guilty. Second degree murder, rape, and sodomy. I put my head down. One of them pictures on the pamphlet, that was the picture the day I got found guilty. I was 23 years old. It was probably the saddest day of my life. I couldn't believe that I got found guilty and I was going upstate for something I didn't even do. I tried to get a retrial, tried to get a motion to retry, tried all kinds of stop sentencing, withheld it. My lawyer tried all kinds, nothing. They said, we're sentencing in September. Beginning of September 1989, they sentenced me to 25 years to life. Within a couple, about a week later, I was from the county jail. They brought me up to a maximum security prison. I was a young kid. I had never been in trouble. I was scared to death. I couldn't believe this happened to me. I figured I'd be out. My lawyer says, we're going to do an appeal. I says, oh, he said, we'll probably have you out here in a couple years. A couple years didn't happen. After a couple years, I was locked up. I was only in jail about a week, and I already had some problems because I had a rape charge, so people used to call me a rapist in prison. I had to stick up for myself, and I used to get in fights quite frequently. I had about 2 years in prison. My trial lawyer passed away of a massive heart attack. Not long after that, the district attorney that tried me, the assistant district attorney, he had a heart attack and died. One day I was in the yard. I was in a maximum security prison up near Buffalo. I was watching a TV show. It was a talk show. It was called Phil Donahue Show. He had these two guys on there. Their names were Peter Neufeld and Barry Scheck. They had just co-founded the Innocent Project in New York City. Him and a bunch of students from Cordova Law School. They were getting guys out with DNA evidence. I said I had DNA evidence in my case. I had the rape kit, the slides, the hair they supposedly in my truck they found. So I sat down, wrote him a letter. I told my mom about it. She wrote a letter too. Approximately 6 months later, they called the jail I was at, and I came down to my counselor's office in the jail, and I talked to Barry Scheck, and they agreed to take on my case. It took us about 2 years to get the evidence. They sent it to a lab. My mother had to pay to get it tested. Cost about almost $2,000 back then. It went to a lab. I'm not sure which lab, maybe in Texas. After about 2 years, it was 1995, almost 90, middle of 95. My mother came up on a Saturday to visit me, and she told me I got the bad news that the DNA test came back inconclusive. The technology we had back then, they couldn't get a DNA profile reading out of none of the evidence. While they were working on my case, one of the law students, she was a law student at Cordova Law School. She now got her bar, she passed her bar, and was a lawyer. She was helping me for a couple years, and I wrote her a letter one day after a couple years, me and her corresponding. My mother paid her a couple $1,000s, and my letter got returned to me. I was wondering what happened. I tried to find her. I tried to write more letters. I could not find her. Later on down the road, I did find her, and I will tell you in a little bit what happened with that. But my case was dormant for a long time. While I was locked up for the next 13 years or so, I was in 7 different maximum security prisons. I've been in riots. The cops have beat me up and broke my ribs. I've been stabbed. I had to stab people. I've seen people hang up. I've seen people die. I've seen people get burned. I've seen it all. Prison is not no camp. I always tell people I would not wish prison on my worst enemy. I call it hell on earth. You're out in the yard with about 1,000 guys. There's always gangs, there's little cliques, and there's nothing but drama and violence 24/7. I was in, there's a lot of maximum security prisons in New York State. I was in like 7 or 8 different ones. I always kept busy in prison. I studied the law. I learned sign language for a little while in prison. I used to work with deaf inmates. I used to lift light weights to stay in shape, because you were always had drama, fighting. I was a power lifter for a long time. I set some records. I was lifting a lot of weight. I did it to keep in shape, keep my mind going, because you got to be strong in mind and heart and in body to be in prison. The weak, you ain't going to make it. I had a little crew I hung out with, mind my own business, but I always stayed busy. I always kept hope alive. My family was my main supporters. None of my friends came to visit me. They actually forgot about me. I didn't really have a name in prison. My number was 89C1152. They didn't go by your name, they went by your number. I didn't celebrate too many Christmases, birthdays, Easters, or Thanksgivings. Don't ever tell me good morning either, because it was never a good morning when I woke up at 6 a.m. because I had to, and the cops, it was a sitting or standing count, and they made it mandatory. And I had to I had program all the time. I had different jobs. I was a welder, work maintenance. I made approximately about 22 cents an hour, probably about $21 a week, $86 maybe a month, give or take a few dollars. The food in prison was slop. I hated it. To this day, I don't really like mashed potatoes too much. But they gave us a lot of carbohydrates, powdered eggs, all the slop that you probably wouldn't want to eat. So it was about 2006 now. I had about 18 years in. My little brother, he went to an Innocent Project convention. Innocent Projects have conventions in different states every year. And in 2006, they had one in Boston. My little brother drove down there, and he ran into Peter Neufeld, Barry Scheck, a couple of the intake people, and asked them to reopen my case. DNA technology had gotten very in-depth, way better than it was when I had my testing done in 94. In 93, it really wasn't that in-depth as it is now. They came out with touch DNA and YSTR DNA testing. So I had to go through the same story, same thing again. I had to get the evidence. Thank God they still had my evidence. I had to get the district attorney, was pretty cooperative in my county. He was a different one. At the time, when I dealt with the other one back in 95, 94, they had the evidence. We agreed on a lab, sent it out to a lab in Texas. The Innocent Project paid for that. That was $45,000 for the DNA test. That closed. They sent slides. It took approximately over almost 2 years, and they came up with a DNA profile of two male DNAs. They always said it was one person. Now they came up with two. Then, November of 2008, they came to the jail and they swabbed me. They wanted my DNA, so the cops from the county or the sheriff's department, there were two new investigators. The old investigators were retired now. We had a lady from the lab. It was down in Texas. I think it was Cellmark Laboratory. They took my DNA, and it was about 2 to 3 weeks later. It was November 21st, 2008. I was down near Elmira. I was about 3.5 hours from my hometown. I called my mother on a Friday, it was. I always called a couple times a week because she used to come up and visit sometimes on the weekend, so I'd call. She told me the Innocent Project called and she wasn't home at times, and they left a message to call the Innocent Project back. So she called the Innocent Project, and then I called her back about a half an hour later. And when I called her back, it was probably one of the happiest phone calls I had in 20 years. My mother said, "Are you sitting down?" I said, "No." They didn't have a seat by the phone, any of the phones, you know. She said, "You're coming home Monday." Well, I broke down in tears, almost 20 years I did. And it was 20 years before that, it was tears of sadness. Now I had tears of joy. My nightmare was finally over. I got my life back. From the age of 19 to almost 43, I was harassed by the cops and I was incarcerated. I had to stay in jail that whole weekend. I had to stay there Friday, Saturday, Sunday. They brought me back to court on Monday. My court in my county from the jail I was in was about a 4-hour ride. Two officers brought me, they chained me all up and brought me back. I got to court and I had to stay in the county jail one more night because my lawyers couldn't get up from New York City in time for my hearing. So they put me in the county jail, and I remember I got back to the county jail and there was a bunch of officers there that I knew from 20 years ago, and they had about 20 something years in. They go, "Oh, Mr. Barnes, we knew you were innocent, blah, blah," and I wasn't trying to hear their crap, but I went through the, okay, whatever, blah, blah. They woke me up the next morning. I was on the front page of the paper. I got ready for court, and I remember I was getting ready for court, and my mother had brought me a suit, and the officer gave me my suit. And I got to the part where I had to tie my tie, and I forgot how to tie a tie, so one of the officers helped me. They threw me in a dog kennel van and took me to court. I got out to the county courthouse. And my lawyer came in the back and said, "There's a lot of people out there." I said, "Okay, I'm ready." I remember I walked in. I never saw so many cameras, so many people. I saw some of my friends I haven't seen in 20 years. They were a little grayer, a little heavier, a little thinner. They were calling my name, "Steve, welcome home." I didn't even recognize hardly any of them. I went in. The judge, he didn't say too much. He just said I was a strong person and blah, blah, and I wasn't trying to hear him either. He says, "I'm vacating your sentence," and he took the prison jewelry off, and they dropped all the chains and the padlocks and all the other rigmarole on the ground, and they said I was free to go home. I remember my heart was going 100 miles an hour, and I was so excited to be home. Then I had a press conference after that, and everybody was asking me, "What are you going to do, and what happened?" And I was like, I was in shock. The world moved on, but I didn't. So here I had to start my life over. I was almost 43 years old. I got out in November. My birthday was in January. I remember my mom, we went to a restaurant after the court proceedings, me, Barry Schack, my lawyers. I had a nice big steak and I only ate a part of it. It was too much for me. I remember driving up my mother's road when I was on the way home and I didn't even recognize my street. A lot of things have changed in the 20 years. Trees were bigger. Places that I hung out were tore down. New places were built. Technology moved on. People were walking around with these little cell phones. I didn't even know what they were. I didn't know nothing about the internet. We didn't have internet access in prison. We had computers, but everything was on little discs. And we didn't have Facebook. We didn't have internet. We didn't have none of that stuff. So I didn't know nothing about any of that. So I got out. I was out a few days. And after I was out a couple months, I was getting used to society because I didn't know nothing about the world changed from 1980s till now we're into 2008. They vacated my sentence on 11/25, but on January 9th of 09, they totally dismissed my indictment. They threw my record. It was totally clean, like I never spent a day in jail. Since then, since January, a couple months after that, January 09, my district attorney in my county and my county executive gave me a job in my county. I work with troubled kids, 19 to 24-year-olds. I've been working with them since I've been out. This February, I've been working with them for 3 years. They get their GED. I get my students. They're very troubled kids. They're like thrown out of all the local schools. They get their GED and they come to me and I got two other guys that work with me and they learn how to do construction. We remodel houses, remodel apartments, we do painting, we do community service, we've done fixing up parks, a little of everything. But before I had gotten my job, before I started my job, they sent me to computer school. And the best part about it is my 11-year-old niece taught me how to use the cell phone and texting. And to this day, I am a professional texter. I really enjoy it. It's probably one of my best things to do. It's very nice that you don't have to talk sometimes. It's very nice. But when I got exonerated, I had to start over my life, and I had to get my license again. I had my job. The Innocent Project was very helpful to me when I got out. They assigned me a social worker. I needed to talk to somebody as I got out in the street. I was very smart for prison. I was prison smart. I wasn't street smart. I needed help to get along and get back into society. I lived with my mom for about 6 months after I got out. And I remember I used to sleep on her couch because that was about the size of my steel bed I laid on for 20 years. I only had a little mattress about a couple inches thick. And then sometimes I'd get up in the middle of the night and I'd walk to my mother's front door and I thought it was the gate. And I would stand there and go like this and my mother would wake me up and said, "Steve, you're home, you're home." I have a little issue with post-traumatic stress syndrome. I don't like being around a lot of crowds. No, I don't like to be cornered. I just want to be left alone sometimes. I've seen a lot of crazy stuff. I do have flashbacks from prison. It's something I'll never, ever forget. I try to put it behind me, but it's in my mind, and it's happened to me, and it's a part of me, and I try to put it behind me, but sometimes it comes back. Can't help it. I almost spent more time in prison than I did on the street. After I got my life in order, I started helping the Innocent Project. They were like my second family. They helped me out dramatically. When I was locked up, I don't like to tell a lot of this, but the medical was really garbage. A lot of jails, we didn't have even a doctor. We had nurse practitioners. I had a few of my teeth knocked out in fights, and I had a few cavities. Instead of fixing my teeth, they ripped all my teeth out of my mouth and gave me dentures. They gave me dentures with my ID number on them. When I got home, I did not want no part of them teeth. The Innocent Project got me a new set of dentures. They helped me with my apartment when I got out. They my social worker was that calls me to this day. I almost been out 3 years. It'll be 3 years, November 25th. It seems like I've been on the street probably about 6 or 7 years. Things out here move really fast.
Things in prison, very slow.
It's the same old story every day. I was told what to do. I had to ask for a shower, ask for a phone call. I had to deal with CO's attitudes. They'd have problems at home. They would come and take it out on us. You'd ask them for a phone call. Man, I don't feel like having you letting you call home. I did a lot of reading while I was in prison. I wrote a lot of letters to my family because when you called home from prison, it was very expensive. They made the rates very high. They were actually robbing our people. I didn't want to put the expense on my mom, so I used to write a lot of letters. Since I've been out, I've did a lot of speaking for the Innocent Project. I've been to Washington, D.C. with Peter Neufeld. I've been to my capital in Albany. I've fought for to change interrogation, filming interrogations in my county. Now they film 95% of the cases that the people they interrogate, they film them. I wish they filmed mine when they did it, but they didn't. Just like if they had the technology we got now in DNA testing, if they had it back in 85, I would have never served a day, but we didn't have that technology. Since I've been out, three people admitted they lied in my trial. Can anything happen to them? Not one thing. After 10 years, statute of limitation runs out and the people are scot-free. There's no problem. The new investigators went to talk to the old investigators. They called them up. They're now retired. They live in another state. They refused to even talk. The jailhouse informant I had in my case, they went to see Queston to talk to him, and he says, I never even testified in the trial. I don't even know what you're talking about. They went and seen that off-duty cop. He told the new investigators, it's my story, and I'm sticking to it, and I'll get away from me. Get off my property. The hair they found in my truck, they tested it a couple years ago, about a year and a half ago after I was out. That hair was my hair. There were cigarette butts in the ashtray in my truck they took, and they said one had lipstick on it and could possibly be hers. They tested all them cigarette butts, and every one of them were mine. I probably gave it to my girlfriend. She took a drag off, put it in the ashtray. Like I said about the gene imprint, that's all junk science. They try to go to trial with that junk science. It's all similarities. There's no such thing as a similar hair or similar dirt. They narrowed it down to 3,000 pairs of jeans. Somebody in the parking lot could have just bumped into my truck. It was a long 20 years. I am not going to say why I gave up hope. I always tell people that it was like a candle. They got the flame. Sometimes it's a little high, and sometimes it's really flickering, and it's almost out. That's how I was sometimes. I had so many ups and downs. Like I told you, I had that lady. She was helping me and became a lawyer. The one I couldn't get a hold of and I lost contact with, the Innocent Project found her for me after I got out, and she got in a car accident. She's been in a coma for the last 13 or 14 years. She doesn't even know that I'm out. She still has my paperwork. Good thing my mother has a whole case file that was in the attic to give to the Innocent Project the second time around, because she's the one that took my file from the Innocent Project from the first round of testing. She took all my trial transcripts, my police reports. The investigators now on the case, it was on America's Most Wanted. They aired the case twice. They interviewed me. I was on the show. My mother was on the show. It's almost, the case is 28 years old almost. It was just turned 28 years old in February, or September 18th. They are continuing to do DNA testing right now on about 6 to 8 individuals. They still haven't solved the case. Will they ever? I hope they do for me, my family, for her and her family, the district attorney's office. I always tell people what happened to her and what happened to me, two wrongs don't make it right. A lot of people always say to me, you're not bitter, you're not hateful. Well, I lived in it. Stressful, hateful, negative, dirty, rotten prison for all them years. And I'm a happy guy now. I tell my story because I want to get the message out, because a lot of people don't realize that there's innocent people in prison. There's a lot of innocent people in prison. They say almost 10% of the population is innocent. They got railroaded, funneled, thrown in the system, and forgot about. In my state alone, I was number 24 in New York State to be exonerated through DNA. Since I've been out, they got another four guys out in my state through DNA. I was number 227th person in the country to be exonerated through DNA. Since I've been out 3 years, the Innocent Project have gotten another 40-something guys out. They're up to 270-something. There's more. There will be more and more. It's just the people are not aware of this problem. Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld started the Innocent Project back in 92, 93. Then since 20-something years later, there's Innocent Projects all over every state. They go as far as Australia, London. Texas and New York State are one of the highest exoneree states. There's cases in Texas where guys got executed that were innocent. They found out after they were executed. I'm lucky New York State did not have the death penalty. I wouldn't be here today. And I would have never got out of prison if it wasn't for DNA and the Innocent Project, because I did almost 20 years. I had 25 life. I had 5 more years to go to the parole board. When you go to the parole board, they want you to show remorse and admit to why you did the crime. I did nothing wrong, and I wasn't admitting to nothing, so they would hit me. Every 2 years, they would hit me and hit me until I would have died. Like I said, it has been 3 years, just right before this Thanksgiving. I remember when I got out in 2008, I had a lot to be thankful. It was right before Thanksgiving. I finally got down to sit down with my family and have a Thanksgiving dinner, and about treated. It was probably one of the happiest days of my life. I looked at my mom and everybody else in my family, and I said, I have a lot to be thankful. Nobody realizes how valuable your freedom is. When they take your freedom away, they take your life away. I didn't have a life. I lived in prison, but I was forced to live in an environment that people were mean. The worst thing about prison, I always say, is you're forced to live around people you hate. On the street, if you hate somebody or you don't get along with them, you can kind of avoid them. In prison, sometimes you're right on the same gallery with that person, and you got to see them all the time, and it's just, next thing you know, it wears on you, and next thing you want to do, you got to fight. You want to fight. Everything's you want to fight. That's the way it is in prison. There's no way around it. I'm not a tough guy. I'm not a gangster, but that's the way you got to live in there. I'm out here in Alaska. I really like Alaska. I probably came at the wrong time of the year. I know it's kind of cold. But I'm from New York, and we do have snowy winters. But I came out here to help the Innocent Project, because there is a lot of innocent people in every state that are innocent and in jail. And the Innocent Project's a nonprofit organization. They run off donations. So I try to help get my story out to let you people know, and you let other people know, that there things like this happen quite frequently. The Innocent Project in New York is a lot bigger than the Innocent Project out here, but they've been in existence for over 20 years. And they have a lot bigger staff. They handle a lot more cases. The Innocent Project in New York, they get 3,000 letters a year. They work on 60 cases a year. And only 1 or 2% of them cases go home, because what happens, a lot of the evidence is destroyed. Because a lot of times in New York, when you exhaust all your appeals, they close the case, they throw your evidence out, you're done. I was thankful that they still had my evidence and everything worked out in my favor. I was one of the ones in the 1%. I got my freedom back, my life. I've did a lot of talking since I've been out here I've been out here a week. I met a lot of nice people, kind people. I know a lot of you are probably my age when I went away to prison, or maybe you're a little older when I got out, my age. I just wish you the best in life. And I know a lot of you are still in college, and you choose in your career and your life. I didn't choose mine. Mine got handed to me. But like I said, I'm still in my 40s, and I always tell people life begins at 40. But I'm a very happy person every day. I got a smile on my face. Some days I tell everybody when I wake up in the morning, it's like Christmas morning to me. I live each day like it's a holiday. I'm very happy I got my life back. When I was locked up all them years, my family was locked up with me. They were with me, but then my family had some turmoils. My little brother was drugs and alcohol, and my sister, she didn't want to really visit me too much. My younger sister, my older sister did. I had a niece when I got out. She was 22 years old. I only seen her a couple times in 20 years. So since I've been out, I rekindled. My family's gotten all back to normal. My brother's in normal. I went to rehab. He's all doing good. He went to college. He's got a good job. Everything's back on track. My family's not stressed out. I'm not. Life is good. It will continue to be good. And I want to thank you all for having me here tonight. And I wish every one of you the best. And thanks for having me in this fine state of Alaska. And I know probably some of you have questions. And I'm free to ask, and we'll go. I don't know how you want to do it, or you raise your hand, I'll just say, go for it. So.
This is KESKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Steve Barnes, who was wrongfully imprisoned for rape and murder for 20 years. He visited Alaska in November and shared his story at an event hosted by the Alaska Innocence Project in the UAA Justice Center on November 2nd. Following his talk, Mr. Barnes responded to questions from audience members. First, he was asked, can the Innocence Project get involved when you're going to trial?
Well, my case, they got involved after I was convicted. Usually, the Innocence Project steps in when all your appeals and everything are exhausted. The Innocence Project is a last resort for help, because a lot of guys already exhausted all their appeals. And if you have DNA evidence, there is some states that they do take cases that are non-DNA. Those are very hard to prove. The DNA is, nobody has the same DNA, so it's a lot easier. But a lot of them cases, the DNA evidence is destroyed or whatever. But usually the Innocence Project come in at the last resort because you exhausted all your other court remedies.
I think that is without exception. The only time the Innocence Project gets involved is when everything else has gone through its system, and as Steve said, it's a last resort.
So is there any way you can keep the evidence around so it does at that last, or throwing it away is not a great idea?
I know. The evidence, it's upon the county.
We have a state law that just passed 2 years ago in Alaska that for certain crimes, they have to keep the evidence for certain periods of time. So in homicides, sexual assaults, they have to keep the evidence as long as the person is incarcerated or still required to register as a sex offender.
But in some states, they don't have the room to store everything. So some counties or other states, they take the evidence, and after you exhausted all your appeals and you're all done, they kind of like, because the Innocence Project, I know, worked on some cases, and the evidence was gone. They couldn't find the evidence. It was destroyed. And when they do that, you have no choice. Your case is done.
Next, he was asked, how did people react in prison during 9/11?
I remember exactly what I was doing. I was at my job, but during 9/11, they locked us all in. We had locked in our cells for the rest of the day. They sent everybody back. They shut the jail down.
Another audience member asked Mr. Barnes, did your DNA testing really cost $45,000?
Yeah, my DNA testing, when they sent it out to the lab, it was the DNA. The Innocence Project bill was $45,000. They did the touch DNA, Touch DNA is when you touch some clothing. That's a new type of DNA. It's very expensive, and they come out with YSTR DNA testing. That's another test that's very in-depth. I don't know how they come up with all the figures, but I know the Innocent Project, they told me that's what mine costed. There was a lot of stuff they sent, clothing, bunch of slides, and I was at a convention down in Houston, Texas when I first got out, because the Innocent Project has them every year in a different state. I was talking to this lady, and she was actually worked the lab that did all my testing. Yeah, she was talking to me. She goes, I know you. And I go, how do you know me? She goes, I did all the DNA testing. I worked for the lab. So I was pretty, you know.
The next question from the audience was, what plans did you have for the future before you were arrested and convicted? And what is your opinion of the criminal justice system?
What were my plans before I went away?
Correct.
I was a construction worker. I had a nice girlfriend of about 4 years. I probably would have got married, maybe had kids. I don't know, I wasn't much of a college person. I did graduate high school, but... And what do I think about the judicial system? Is it the best? No, I think it's... They say our system's the best in the world, or not the world, the country. But it failed me, and it failed many others. I don't really like the system, the way the jury system is. A lot of people on juries, they automatically assume, they wouldn't arrest him if he wasn't guilty. He must have did something. That's how, is the system broken? Yeah, it's broken. Will it ever get fixed? Probably not. I try to change things, what I can do. A lot of us exonerees, we try to speak for our own states. Each state has different rules. Some states don't have this rule, some state does. We try to go around and change these things. That's what the Innocent Project does. We all try to work together and change things and try to make it better. So this does not happen again, but it's an uphill battle. Yes, sir.
From the time you were first considered for this crime, is there anything you would have done differently?
As I look back, because I prevented anything, I've been railroaded. There's a few things I would have done. When I went up there for questioning, I would have never answered a question. I would have said, I want my lawyer until I answer a question. I would have never signed a waiver to have him search my truck. I would have just kept my mouth shut and never cooperated. That's the way I would have do different. So.
Would it have helped your case if you did not submit to the initial questioning? Could you have asked for a lawyer without saying anything?
Yes, I just answered that. You can. I did ask for a lawyer when I was interrogated. I wish I never even answered any questions, but I did because I had nothing to hide and I was trying to cooperate with this case. So.
Next, another audience member asked, did you receive any compensation from the state for being wrongfully imprisoned?
Yes, I did. They just didn't say, here, Mr. Barnes, we're sorry, here's a bunch of money. It didn't happen that way. I had to go to a court of claims. I had to get a lawyer. They did give me some money. It took a few years. I always tell people, what price would you put on 20 years of your life? What is it worth? Not a lot of money. Everybody says there's not enough money in the world to put a price on the prime years of your life. I'm lucky that New York State does have compensation laws, but some states don't. And that's what exonerees do in other states to try to change these laws. A lot of times they just say they don't even want to admit they're wrong. They don't even say they're sorry. They just say, well, we made a mistake, but nobody even admits to it, and they don't even give a guy a dime. And these guys are back out in society. You railroaded them, and they've got nothing. Some of them can't find a job. They can't get back on track. You know what I mean? So,
yeah. Alaska does not have a compensation statute, so we have work to do.
How do you feel about the prison system in America?
I hate it. I don't like prison. I don't want to go there. I went back there after I got out of prison. I went and visited a guy that I worked out with for a couple of years. I was very nervous about going back in there, but the prison system had changed in New York State. I don't know about all across the other states. Our prison system, they've been downsizing. Say they used to have a lot of programs in the prison. They had vocational. As people retire, teachers retire, they cancel the program out. There's minimal things to do. You work in the mess hall. They have GED classes. They don't have much vocational. Sometimes you are on a waiting list to get a job in prison because there's so many people and not enough jobs. So the system is downsizing, and it doesn't rehabilitate anybody for anybody that's in there that does need help. So the system is not good in my eyes. So,
do you have any idea how many people in the United States have been exonerated?
275 using DNA.
And probably 275 have been exonerated. It's on the website.
And non-DNA, they estimate about 750.
750 for non-DNA cases. Because the Innocent Project in New York, I know that most of their cases are DNA. They did handle a few cases that were non-DNA. Those cases are a lot harder to prove.
Another audience member asked, does it still take approximately 2 years for DNA test results to come back?
And sometimes it takes longer than 2 years. Mine, it took 2 years. Sometimes it takes 2 to 3 years, depending on the type of evidence, how old it is, what type of testing is being done. So at the minimum, it could be 2. It could be even less years. It depends on what lab's doing it. It's a fluctuating time period. It's going to at least take 2 or more years.
Has suffering from PTSD made it difficult for you to remove yourself from the violent mindset acquired in prison?
My demeanor, I do suffer from post-traumatics. I'm not that bad on the street. In prison, I was really, the way I had my guard up all the time, I had to fight, I had to be aggressive. On the street, I'm more laid back now that I've been out of 3 years. But if you do push my buttons or back me in that corner, I will snap. But I don't like to go to a lot of crowded places. I fall back. I hang out with certain individuals. I kind of like stick to myself. I live out in the country. I like the quietness, peace of mind.
Did any of your fellow inmates believe you were innocent?
Yes. There was, as a matter of fact, there's four inmates in New York State that have been exonerated. I was actually in prison with four of them guys. And I did have conversations with him, and I see him quite frequently, at least once a year. Or if I go down to New York City, I hang out with him. I do see him once a year as the Innocent Project has conventions in different states. This year they're having a convention in Kansas City. Last year it was in Cincinnati, Ohio. There was 96 of us guys down there from across the country. They added up all the time, all of us guys did. It was almost 3,000 years. For no reason. We are all innocent.
Another person from the audience asked Mr. Barnes, when you were in prison, were you able to mind your own business or did you have a clique?
When I was in prison, I did stick with, I had a little crew. There was about 4 or 5 of us. We hung out. Some jails are racially divided. You go out in the yards and you'll see Spanish, black, they are racially I got along with most everybody. After you get about 10, 15 years in prison, people see how you carry yourself. After I got a few stabbings under my belt and a few violent fights, people do respect you. Plus, when I was a power lifter, I was very strong. People used to watch me lift weights, and they had second thoughts about tangling with me. So to answer your question, there was little clicks, but yeah.
Do you have any idea why the original investigators worked so hard to convict you?
The original investigators worked so hard to convict me is because people just kept putting my name in the mix. And like when I went around that road, I wasn't going to go through the roadblock, but I missed the turn and circled around in the convenience store. The cops just had blinders on. They just focused on me. They just kept drilling me, being on top of me. They didn't want to hear nothing about any other suspects. There was a small town. It was getting through over 3 year old case. They wanted to solve this. They didn't care. They just built the case up on me. Like I said, it's just people kept throwing my name in the mix. And that's how I just, they caught right up. It's very easy to get caught up in the system. There's exonerees in other states that were police officers, lawyers, firemen. There's a movie called Actual Innocence. You'll see it. There's 200 and something guys. There's a group of, it's about 250 exonerees, but it's about a bunch of them in New York City and other states. They tell their story. You know, what happened to them. The system snatches you up. You can get an indictment very easy, railroad you, it's on your way, and it's tougher than hell to get out.
The next question from the audience was, how would you like to see jails changed in the United States?
More programs in jails. I'd like to see medical improve, because we are not treated very human. We're just like a bunch of animals. We're like a number. They don't care about us. If we die, move you on, move another one in. All these prisons are overcrowded. In New York State, they had a lot of laws. They were called the Drug Rockefeller laws. They did change them. They changed a lot of sentences. Guys were getting harsh sentences for little felony drug charges. So they did downsize a lot of the prisons.
How many females versus males have been exonerated?
I met 4 female exonerees. There's none in New York State, but there's other female exonerees in, I'm not sure exactly what states, but I do meet them every year. I don't know, maybe Bill knows. Do you remember?
I don't know the exact figures, but I would bet it's 5 or 10% female.
Yeah.
The last question from the audience asked of Mr. Barnes was, based on your interrogation experience, how reliable do you view confessions when an individual admits to committing a crime?
Confessions, there is a lot of cases that the Innocent Project handled that false confessions do happen. There's a couple cases in New York State. People had signed confessions. They weren't even guilty. The way the cops drill you and coerce you, just sign this, we'll let you go. There was a bunch of cases in 5 guys in New York City, the Central Park rapist case. They were all young kids, 16, 17 years old. The cops coerced them into signing false statements. And 10 years, 15 years down the road, the cop was, the way he interrogated them, he told all these guys lies. Just sign this, you can go home. It happens a lot. A lot of people think it's kind of weird that if you didn't do nothing, why would you sign a confession? But it does happen. Happens a lot. It's a lot of the cases, you know. So, well, just want to thank you all for having me, and I appreciate you listening to me, and I wish you all the best.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Steve Barnes, who was wrongfully imprisoned for 20 years for murder and rape. He was exonerated in 2009 through DNA testing obtained by the Innocence Project. Steve Barnes visited Alaska in November and shared his story at an event hosted by the Alaska Innocence Project and the UAA Justice Center on November 2, 2011. A special thanks to UAA for recording this week's program. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack.